So good evening, and welcome to this event on Myanmar. My name is Jürgen Hark. I'm the director of the Sosbuhok Southeast Asia Center here at LSE. I'm also a faculty member in the International Relations Department. It's great to see this turnout, and I hope you like what we're going to do. Anyway, let me start by making some introductory remarks. Now, as everyone here in this room will know, the NLD-led government came to power in the spring of 2016 on the back of the party's overwhelming victory in the November 2015 polls. You will also know, obviously, that Myanmar's 2008 constitution has enshrined a presidential system that in practice did not allow Daw Aung San Suu Kyi to claim the office of president. Yet the government that we have in place now is, of course, headed by the Nobel laureate, who assumed in April 2016 the newly legislated position of state councillor. Now, evaluating the NLD record in government is in many ways assessing the achievements of Daw Su, as state councillor, minister maybe in the president's office, and union minister for foreign affairs. What is a suitable yardstick for assessing this record? You might say you could turn to the 2015 NLD election manifesto, but I would say that this could be perhaps too vague for this purpose. Another thing to do might be to compare the record of the NLD government against that of the previous one, which was headed by the former general Hussein Sein, from 2011 to 2016. Now, if we do that, we would first of all, of course, need to acknowledge as to what that government had actually achieved. And I will put to you that despite the very many challenges that government has left, there were a few things which they did do. First of all, that previous government was able to transform, I think, the political climate of the country in major ways. It secondly engaged most ethnic armed groups in a process of dialogue that, despite many issues and impediments, led to a so-called nationwide ceasefire accord. Thirdly, the government under Hussein Sein prepared Myanmar for its re-inclusion into the regional and global economy, and also probably markedly enhanced Myanmar's international standing. Obviously, there are very many caveats one could make. The 2008 constitution was not significantly amended during his days in power. Also, obviously, the role and autonomy of the military were unchanged by the time that the previous government left office. You could also say that in terms of the ceasefire or the peace process, so-called, in Myanmar, that actually only 8 ethnic armed groups signed up to the 2015 ceasefire. And that some of these other ethnic armed groups are still fighting the Tamador to this day. Now, we all need to bear that in mind, but the point I'm trying to make is that the previous government did establish at least something of a record against which we can compare what the NLD-led government has done since. Now, to help us do that, I've assembled this panel consisting of 3 wonderful people. First of all, there's Dr. Daw Khin Mamatsi, who is the inaugural Daw Aung San Suu Kyi Research Fellow in Gender and Burmese Studies at the International Gender Studies Center at Lady Margaret Hall in Oxford. She is a keen observer, obviously, of Burma's politics and the recent democratization process, and she was herself an election observer in 2015. She has been doing many things, developing gender-specific educational curricula, worked as a documentary filmmaker, and advised many institutions, particularly in Australia, on Myanmar. It's a great pleasure to have her with us. She's currently working on a research project, she just told me, on Buddhism, nationalism, and gender. Secondly, then we have Professor Mari Lowell, who is a professor in education and South Asian studies at the UCL Institute of Education. She has also worked in various advisory capacities over the years in relation to Myanmar, And I actually first met her in Myanmar, even though UCL is not that far away from LSE. We met in Yangon. Probably we were just thinking about that, 2005, 2006. So it's a long time ago. And she recently published a very interesting book I thought I should mention, which is entitled Understanding Reform in Myanmar. It has a very particular take on it and explores the roles and the role in particular of Myanmar egress as a sort of agent of change. Thirdly, we have Dr. David Brenner, who is currently a lecturer in international relations at the University of Surrey. He has a particular interest in conflict studies, and as part of his PhD, which he did here at LSE, David spent about a year or so in the Karen State, in Kachin State, and I would say that better than most of us, he knows what a real insurgent actually looks like on the ground and as to what these people do in the field. Anyway, it's a great pleasure to welcome all of you back to the LSE, and let me just say how we plan to do this. First of all, we will proceed in the same order I just outlined, with each speaker having about 10 minutes to sort of make some initial remarks. I will also make some myself, even though I'm the chair. I hope that's okay. Then, if there are any sort of issues or questions that come up for the panel members, we will sort of just raise these among ourselves before we then open it up to Q&A. All right.
Thank you so much, Jay. And when you hear someone say, like, comprehensively, I say, wow, now it is like a kind of, highlighting someone else, not me. So thank you. And now I have to keep up with all the things that he just mentioned. And thank you so much, all of you, coming after 6:30. I'm very impressed by LSE. And it's wonderful to see young students in this room and interested in Burma. How delightful I am. Thank you. And today in my talk, I just want, because we are given only 10 minutes, so I will be briefly covering up this. There are so many things that the new government has done. Many of them will be impacting on long term. It's like a kind of, still there are multiple challenges, such as we all know, conflict in northern state, military tight control, presence of ultra-nationalist monk organization, lack of critical thinking skill, and mindset that produced by military regime, and inflation, poverty, lawlessness, labor rights, exploitation, leaks can go on. And it is for Aung San Suu Kyi, she is trying to avoid confrontation with the military. That is like a major challenge for her and for all the Burmese. When she is trying to avoid confrontation with the military at any cost, which means that she is doing one-sided compensation. A lot of things are not smooth forward as she planned to do. So, and here is again, today I want to talk about what she has done, particularly major breakthrough is bringing ethnic peoples into parliament. So like including speaker of lower house, upper house, and vice president. That is like groundbreaking in Burma. Burma politics always dominated by Burmese. She, even with the genuine dedication and fresh strategy and commitment, she decided to do peace talk as her aim. Once she came to the power, she said that, I don't promise anything, but I will try three things: peace, constitution, and law and justice. Nonetheless, she has to follow the previous military regime path, dealing with ethnic armed groups as the military did it before. As Jagan already explained it, which means that she only invites 8 out of 21 ethnic armed groups. So which means 8 of them are signed in 2015 ceasefire. So she can invite only 8 of them. If anyone went to come to the peace conference, peace table, or Pinlong talk, they need to sign first the peace ceasefire. So which is again like a kind of negotiation is again for the ethnic people, still military line. She is thinking about peace talk as her signature project. She is very much committed to it. But I met people in Laogai and Shan State running away from the fighting. And one old woman told me that in her life she never experienced military use helicopter to drop bomb and killing indiscriminately. So it means that, like, one hand, she is trying to do peace talk, peace conference as a Pin Long, very big name she is taking. At the same time, the military has been increased their attack on ethnic people. They are not incidental. What does it mean? The same time it happened, it means that military is trying to undermine her peace process. And it is not about conflict of armed groups and Aung San Suu Kyi. Armed groups and military, it is conflict and power struggle with state government and military. Military is showing who is driving the seat. Military is also showing lack of direct authority of the state government to them, on them. It is also a warning sign of the military that they still operate separate identity and beyond the control of civilian and the Aung San Suu Kyi government. And they can, that's also reflecting, they can create the failure of NLD initiative at any time. But what is not only the military showing of who is in charge, but more importantly, what happened is damage to the NLD. What damage is like, and she actually focused on, she focused on three things. She avoiding military, she requests and asked ethnic leaders three things. One, she said, do not focus on what you gain, trying to give up what you have. The first. Second, avoid holding arms to fight for what you want. Be brave to give up. So that is like that led to growing criticism and resentment among the armed groups leaders as well as ethnic youths. Increase of radical youth are not just in Rakhine State, now increasing in Xi'an and Kachin State because they feel like the Aung San Suu Kyi, that they voted because she challenged the military, now no longer voicing for them. And also, that resentment is not just one ethnic group. It is shared by among the ethnic group increasingly. So recently, like last week, Mon State had there as a protest. That protest was symbolic and political because the NLD parliament decided by vote that a bridge in Mon State will be changed the name to Aung San, General Aung San, and people protest. What does it mean? They are showing that you know, Aung San is not in charge. Aung San doesn't represent Mon people. But interestingly, that is a protest was supported by a lot of ethnic groups, but all Xi'an and Kachin. So you can see that there's like an increased collaboration with that. But the major challenge for her is, as we all know, Rohingya issue. Rohingya and Rakhine Buddhist issue. Rakhine itself is a marginalized minority. Rakhine conflict will send invitation to the military with the NDSC, National Defense Council, which they outvoted, they outnumbered the NLD. NLD has always been the weakest, the NLD's weakest link is always Rakhine State. Rakhine is the only state that she failed to win, whereas all the ethnic states that she won. So Rakhine always treat her with distrust. And they are supported by Mabata extreme monks, and also like their Mawata and Rakhine nationalist ideologies are reflected with military. So that was still is the main justification of the armed forces. They can come back with NDSC at any time to the politics. Even though just Aung San Suu Kyi appointed Kofi Annan as a core machine in last year, as you all know, an insurgent group of Rohingya attacked Border Patrol police and killing 9 of them. That led to repercussion of the Burmese army. So recently, there is a state, 2 days ago, there is a conference, a protest in Rakhine State. Rakhines are protesting NLD. Recently, they gave away ID card for the Rohingya. So that is like, they were protesting like an NLD for favoring Muslim. And so that is actually the like, so and I want to skip out the issue of constitution. As we all know, the constitution, changes of constitution is impossible. And even though like their constitution is strategically designed to continue military only with the collaboration of who follow their disciplined democracy. So clearly, the government had no plan to change constitution. So she is stuck with the constitution, and it's a little room that she can move over. So now it's like, and so you can see that once you're on this is on the 19th of March, so like 2 days ago, and there's a dinner with the chef, military chef, commander-in-chief, and then Wu Tengzhi. Very close relationship, clearly indicating brotherhood. So, which is like a kind of, in a sense that like, you know, they are closely still working, and there's no way that you change. So now, I'd like to point out very quickly about NLD, about law and justice. NLD has proposed, one of them is law and justice. And often we forgot, when we talk about Burma, we talk about economic conflict. But what about people in everyday life? What kind of law they have? What kind of justice they have? We actually overlook at it. So here is like a kind of, you know, military legacy. If we actually in research, and we all know that pedagogy of oppressed. So what kind of mindset? Militarization produces militarized culture that appreciate violence. But also militarism is extreme form of patriarchy that affect women. So there are a lot of violence increase, lawlessness increase, but also particularly gender-based violence. So it is like a kind of axe throwing, revenge pornography to the extreme, like kind of rape, all this stuff are happening in Burma. So here is like a kind of, so, and rape is second largest crime in Rangoon, involving 70% of children. So this is like clearly indicating that it's like, kind of, you know, the violence, increase of violence in Burmese society. So I don't have a time to talk about it. That is like, I know, 3 days ago, the famous monk, Wiyatu, head of the Mahatta, preached with the people. She's basically saying that if a girl marries a drug addict, we will not raise our religion. We will not raise our race. But if he married to Kala, which is Muslim, we would lose our race and religion. But more interestingly and more annoyingly, that is like he said, if a woman has a capacity to support husband, she can get a husband. If not, I will send monks. If not, they should choose a dog over Kala. If local dogs are not good enough, I will order dogs from overseas. That is a famous man. So that is a, like, you know, that is the reality. And so far, like a kind of nobody is, you know, like, you know, are taking into account of this justice. So of course, like, you know, law and justice is an NLD they themselves face of being killed. They are prominent men are being killed by extremists. So here is like to wrap up is like, you know, there is a lot of things that NLD is doing in behind and taking longer run, but they are increasingly, for example, this case show that MLD even cannot confront the killing of their own prominent lawyer who actually created state counselor position of herself. Thank you.
Hi, thank you very much. I'm going to talk briefly about issues of education and link them to issues of conflict and peace. What I was most interested in coming in this evening was to look at continuity and change between what we had in a President Thein Sein and what we now have under State Councillor Aung San Suu Kyi. Why education? For those of you who don't know my work, I mean, I'm at the Institute of Education, but I think also education was absolutely key in bringing about the transition that we had. And it started largely not because of state education, but because of civil society and education that they brought about that was in the ethnic states. I mean, I put some very familiar faces up there, some of the ethnic states, but also in the heartland in Yangon and Mandalay after 2005. And it's without these civil society organizations, we would actually not have the transition that we're all talking about today. Now, the actual education reform started in 2012, and it continues to this day. What is really interesting is how much continuity we've actually had in this education reform. My understanding in speaking to advisors to the NLD when they were campaigning before 2015 was that they were going to throw out what had been done under the Thein Sein government and that they'd start again. Actually, this is not at all what has happened. So between 2012 and 2015, we had the Comprehensive Education Sector Review, and we also had the EPIC Committee and the Parliamentary Committee. And there was a whole big fight between the various factions of what they wanted to do in education. There was also, as I was sitting slightly on the outside, the NNER, which is a civil society group originally linked to the NLD. This led to massive student protests because when the new law was enacted, so this is an image from 2015, and we shouldn't forget that because this could come again. Education was seen as a key battleground. Now, what is really interesting is post-2015, so when in the last year, the actual strategic plan, which was released only a few weeks ago, has barely tweaked what was developed under the Thein Sein government. So continuity in that sense can also be a good thing because it brings a certain amount of stability, but it hasn't taken into account the student demands and it hasn't actually brought in other reforms. And it's certainly, well, one thing has changed, actually. It has reduced the role of civil society in making these changes. In fact, Dr. Thein Nguyen, who is the head of the NNER, just produced a three-pager, I think it was 2 days ago or 5 days ago, complaining loudly about the fact that the NNER had not been invited to contribute to the strategic plan. Part of the issue where we haven't seen further progress either is decentralization. And when, again, I spoke to people I know within the NLD who work in education, they said, well, largely it's because we don't have the capacity in the state government, so that's the problem. So education reforms at the center, not quite what we would have expected in terms of taking things forward. The biggest thing which I think has been missed is actually with regard to education reform in the ethnic states. So, I think most of you will be aware that there are separate education systems across most of the ethnic states. They are run by civil society, they're run by ethnic armed groups. I've worked on three of them, Karen, Mon, and Kachin states. They came up largely in protest to the Burmanization program in the 1960s, and they have been key in providing education to children, mainly in mother tongue, in the various ethnic states, in defiance of the state education system. These are really big systems. I'm just going to show you a few photographs from over the years. This is in Mon State, where this is one of the Mon National Schools. I think this is actually the Mon National High School in Ye, and this is the one in Misar, which is on the other side of the ceasefire line, or at the headquarters of the MNEC. And if you go north and you go up to Northern Shan State and you look at what civil society has very recently started providing These are Kachin communities, which are provide civil society. So this is not KIO and KIA provided. This is civil society in northern Shan State, Jingpo-speaking communities, which have provided private schools. And actually what's interesting in the work in Kachin State and in northern Shan State is that as the conflict has increased, civil society provides alternative education, and more parents are taking their children out of state education and choosing to send their children to the alternative education because the reforms are not meeting their needs, and that's really what I want to talk about. This is in Michina with head teachers. We weren't allowed to actually take photographs in the schools, in the KIA-run schools, and this is a post-school sort of graduate education level. Again, also Liza and Maja Yang, we weren't allowed to photograph. Now, why am I showing you these photographs? Well, in part, it's to give some reality to these alternative education systems, which remain entirely separate from this, which is the NCA, the peace process. It's really interesting that right through, and this continues, it's another continuity under this government, what is right through, it's the peace process and the education reform process have been kept separate. But actually, the conflict is about identity, it's about the use of language, and it's about the use of education systems. So why those two have been kept separate is an absolute mystery. So if we look at the peace process post-2015, so under this government, we had the first 21st Century Panlong Conference in September 2016, where there were only presentations and no discussions, and non-signatories were present, but actually it wasn't inclusive either because we didn't have the three groups. Panglong 2, 21st Century Panglong 2 is not yet, we don't have a date yet, and obviously there's increased violence. So what I was particularly interested in talking about or starting to raise this evening is how the peace process and ethnic education remain delinked, how there is limited interaction between the relevant stakeholders, and how we are still talking about a political dialogue for which we actually don't even have a date. Now, this is sad because in many ways language is a cultural marker. And for those of you who might come and say, but actually there is now ethnic language being taught in government schools, yes, that is correct. It's taught as a foreign language. In some cases, in one state, it's taught during school hours, but actually in most cases, taught after school hours. But it's taught as a foreign language. What the parents actually want is their children being taught in their mother tongue, at least at primary school level. So the ethnic language as a medium of instruction, and that's obviously for pride and maintenance of ethnic identity and educational advantages. I'm coming to my last slide, Jürgen, don't worry, I stick to time. But what's most important is that language is actually a political marker, and research that Ashley South and I did in the last couple of years shows that not only that as the conflict rises, that parents take their children out of government schools, but also that the positions of those who actually are running these schools is directly parallel to their position on the peace process. This is particularly evident in northern Shan and in Kachin State. So that's linked to the fact that they're imagining a country in a very different way from the central government. So I just want to end by saying that by de-linking, or by actually missing the opportunity to link those two issues together, the government has continued the legacy of the same government, so continuity can be good, but it has missed a big opportunity in being able to be more inclusive vis-a-vis all those ethnic groups, many of which are still fighting. Thank you.
Thanks for being here. Thanks to you. Thanks a lot for kind of raising some of the themes that I also want to speak about. The conflict is about identity, first of all. And then I won't be speaking much about the NLD government's policies, but rather about the silences of the NLD government and its effects on minority communities, on especially the kind of growing ethno-nationalism. We've seen the kind of imagination of a different place among ethnic minorities, and how this actually sparks not just, or doesn't just exacerbate the conflict between ethnic minorities and the government. So we normally look at Myanmar's conflict as in like a conflict between ethnic armed groups and the government. But actually how this sparks a lot of conflict between ethnic minorities at the moment as well. And so this is based on some recent research in Michina, in what we just heard about in Kachin State, where I've been looking at some of these things. So my argument here really is that the peace process, the vehicle of the peace process in the previous administration, in the administration now, doesn't really address many of these identity issues here. And that actually the escalation of conflict that we've seen since Aung San Suu Kyi is in power in the north of the country has kind of grown the intransigence of ethnic minority communities, of the so-called street, rather than just the elites, the leaders. And this is what I want to walk us through now. So, interestingly, as we have seen already, at the same time that we have a peace process, and this is a picture here of the peace process or the peace conference in August and September last year, the conflict has escalated to an actually unseen extent since the 1980s. So at the same time, you had not just government offensives being driven against rebel-held positions in the north of the country. So this is Kachin State, this is Northern Chan State, but also joint rebel offensives against government-held positions of what we call the Northern Alliance, Kachin, Palaung, Kukang troops. And the last headline here is just from earlier this month. And so the kind of growing humanitarian catastrophe that isn't addressed, as well as the escalation of the conflict there, has grown the ethno-nationalism on the streets of places like Michina. So Michina now is the provincial capital of Kachin State, which is under government control. Interestingly, there, though, things have changed over the years as well. These flags that you're seeing here used to be the flags of the Kachin Independence Organization. These days, they're often taken as the flag of Kachin land, more generally, by people. And here, the role of Kachin people, Kachin churches, but also particularly the Kachin youth is very important, so student groups, for instance. And they have lost a lot of faith in the NLD government, particularly because the conflict has escalated, humanitarian suffering has escalated, and people feel betrayed, as we've already heard, by Aung San Suu Kyi, whom they have majority kind of voted for in the elections. And the humanitarian access to IDPs for ICRC, etc., has actually deteriorated and since August been cut completely in the controlled areas of ethnic armed groups up there. So, and what sorts of, when you speak to people there, what sorts of has given them the last sort of death stroke of like the faith in the government very much was not just Aung San Suu Kyi's silence, which is very much explainable maybe with the difficult relations to the Tatmadaw and that people are actually agreeing to, you know, deal with in some ways, but her embracement of the Tatmadaw offensive against what was Northern Alliance offensive, nevertheless, saying that the government is driving its utmost to return to the situation to normalcy. The valiant effort of the Tatmadaw and security forces has resulted in stabilizing a certain degree of stability. So the kind of implicit bracing that was in there has put people off there a lot. And this is in particular because they feel they have nobody to talk to anymore. They've been voting for the NLD, thinking maybe a bit overambitiously that there might be change. And now they're saying, well, now we have nobody to talk with. So important here is really the role of the youth for taking a particular stance. Youth leaders, for instance, tell you that, well, we are very important. Older people have gone through 60 years of military rule. They fear, but for many of them, only peace would be okay. But for the younger generation, we are not afraid, and we have to plan for the future. I mean, when you see how our people are suffering, we can no longer trust the Burmese anymore. That's the dream we have, Aung Dang. And Aung Dom is actually a quite special word here to use, and this is what I've heard a lot in Michina now. When you cheers with Kachin people, You might say Ong Dang or Ong Dom. Depending on what you use, it connotates your political stance on a certain issue, which is the future of Kachin State. Using Ong Dom, what is being used here, you mean independence, which gives very little room for negotiations, really, about the political future of Kachin State. If you mean Ong Dang, which has been used much more before, I had the impression at least, it means for victory, which is a bit much more flexible, actually. So this was an event that was very interesting. I've been attending Mithuna in January, the Kachin State Day, and you've seen, like, at the Manau Park, the festival ground, you've seen two different festivities going on parallelly. The top one here is the NLD official festivity, quite deserted. The other one there was packed with something like 5,000 people. Kachin people organized a parallel event there, and they were wearing the uniforms of the Kachin Independence Army in a government-controlled town, speaking about Ong Dong to independence all the time. So the thing here, which isn't really reflected in the peace process at the moment, when we are talking with ethnic armed groups and the government, etc., that the leaders of these ethnic armed groups and also the KIO sometimes take a much more compromising stance than what we might find on the street these days. So one KIO negotiator here was telling me that, well, we as a KIO, we try to explain that we should be satisfied with genuine federal rights rather than independence. But it's a difficult position for us, because basically we can't negotiate this with our own constituency. So I have to speed up a little bit. What is, though, interesting on this event as well was not just the two different events, but the Vigilante movement that has separated these two different events, which is known locally as the Pachasan movement, which has come into being as a movement against the drugs crisis, heroin, amphetamine crisis in the area. And this Vigilante movement now isn't just a Vigilante movement. It's embedded in a much larger international project. It's embedded in the understanding of that drugs are being used to eradicate and kill the Kachin youth, and therefore one needs to build the Kachin youth for the future of the nation, which is quite a difficult thing at the moment when one thinks that Mithuna is a very multi-ethnic place, where a vigilante movement that is targeting drug users, for instance, then doesn't just target their own co-ethnics, but also other ethnicities, as for instance, Shani people in Mithuna, who then come to prop up their own vigilante militias, known as P2Cs, that are linked to the Tatmadaw, where they're getting the weapons from, which then kind of sparks a lot of new cycles of violence, this time not so much between the minority and the majority, but actually between the different minorities. So as an outlook here, there is competing narratives about the land, of course. This map on top here is a map some Shani politician shows you, and he brings this historian saying, well, you see, in like the 12th, 11th century, this has already been our land. Then, of course, another one shows you another map where this has been their land. Well, the problem with the peace process then really is that we are talking about institutional arrangements like plurinational federalism, etc., to address power sharing, you know, according to certain identity containers in a way, according to where Kachin State for the Kachin, Shan State for the Shan, like where many of these power sharing arrangements actually might entrench some of the ethnic identities and conflicts even further. And this is not to say that it's not understandable that people speak about power sharing according to ethnic lines. This is not to say that ethnic minority rights, etc., need not be enshrined in the peace process, etc. It is to say that we need to actually find additional vehicles to transform these very entrenched ethnic identities that have been entrenched over colonial rule and decades of protracted conflict in our peace process. And I think what Mary was saying here about education, for instance, is quite an important point to make in that regard. Thanks.
just want to sort of round this off by making a few remarks about foreign policy, about 5 points really. So the first is that obviously Dorsu has perhaps in comparison to other incumbents more power really than anyone really to shape Myanmar foreign policy, given that she's the state councillor. Second point, she has not opted for any major reorientation of foreign policy.
In fact, there's a lot of continuity between what the current government is doing and what the Thein Sein government was doing, you know, and to some extent even what governments before then were doing. And what I'm referring to here is that all of these governments are committed to a non-aligned and independent foreign policy. And you can see it in the Thein Sein years, but also under Dorsu's leadership. There's now obviously a much greater focus on diversifying the foreign relationships than it had been possible under military rule. But that is the primary point to make. There was, in the 2015 LND election manifesto, a point about standing firm on the side of genuine democratic values. But I haven't actually seen that in the implementation of foreign policy as regards, let's say, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or more generally in Myanmar foreign policy. So maybe that's still something to come as the years go by. But there's no evidence of that happening really so far. So let me just make a few remarks about some of Myanmar's major international relationships. One of them, obviously, is with the United States. And during the years of the previous government, that relationship had progressed quite nicely towards renormalization. Which you can sort of find evidence for in terms of the two presidential visits that President Obama actually made to Myanmar. The relationship is still being deepened as the events of September 2016 make clear when Dorsu visited Washington. Then the most of the remaining sanctions on the country were lifted. And also the GSP preferences were restored. However, it's a little ironic because my interpretation of that anyway is that it was more to do with the Obama administration wanting to lift those sanctions than Dorsu explicitly calling for all of them to go. And I think that needs to be seen in the context of Dorsu obviously having been reliant on these sanctions in the past to advance her own political objectives in the domestic context. So what we now have in terms of U.S.-Myanmar relations is what is called the partnership. And the two countries met for the first partnership meeting in November 2016. And you have to look at this in terms of a dialogue, really, with an interagency delegation coming from the U.S. As well as from the other side and coming to a meeting of minds with all sorts of portfolios represented from state to commerce, treasury, defense, USAID, and so on and so forth. So that is certainly in the works. I can't really speak much about the turn of events the bilateral relationship may have to endure under the current American President Trump, because we know far too little as of yet as to how he might want to look at that relationship. But it's something to watch. More important, perhaps, for our purposes here tonight is the relationship Myanmar has with China. Now, that obviously was a major one under military rule, given the sort of dependence on the part of the military dictatorship on Beijing, given its relative isolation within the global context. But I argued a couple of years ago in 2015 that bilateral relationship hit pretty much rock bottom, at least compared to the post-Cold War period more generally, given the perceived sort of links China had with one of the ethnic armed groups, the Myanmar National Democratic Alliance Army, or Kokang, which are to be found at the north of the country, on the border in Shan State. And the MNDAA is, as you will know, one of the forces that emerged when the Communist Party of Burma was dissolved in the late 1980s. Now, the thing was that in February of 2015, Kokang forces had tried to retake positions which they had lost 6 years earlier. And the spillover of the fighting that erupted thereafter led to what I took to be the downturn, because it involved all sorts of harsh, I guess, or at least symbolic talking between the two sides, as well as live shelling right on the border. But in any case, the question is as to whether Dorsu has been able to repair the relationship. And I would argue that she did try. She did undertake as the first visit to a major power, the visit to China. So even before she went to the U.S. And Japan, she also quite cleverly, I think, took the decision to avoid having to pronounce a decision on the question whether or not to lift the suspension. Which was imposed in relation to Misson Dam, which had been something that the Thein Sein administration had taken early in, sort of, also it was in September 2011. In any case, she also asked China for help in the peace process. So this is again, where it all comes together. And the Chinese have been much more helpful, I guess you could say, and so far as they've been trying to coax various ethnic groups to come together, to have dialogue, and to move forward with the peace process by signing up to the nationwide ceasefire. It's just that it's not happening. And you might actually say that the extent to which there are still links between Chinese entities, private persons, etc., in Yunnan in particular, and these groups such as the MNDAA, these are still, I think, leading to suspicions about the extent to which China is playing an ambiguous role in the peace process. I know things have changed when it comes to the media, but it sort of a smile came to me almost when I read the Global New Light Myanmar sort of recently, where it was suggested one of the commentaries that it is beyond our understanding that someone might be masterminding as to what is happening on the border. And that obviously was a reference to China. Anyway, so the last point on this is that the major challenge the Dorsu government has been facing in terms of the international reputation of the country clearly has to do with Rakhine State. And in this regard, again, very early on, she took a bold move, controversial one, by trying to neutralize the issue in so far as she asked Kofi Annan to form an advisory commission to look into as to what could be done in relation to Rakhine State. Obviously, He's published an interim report recently, so you can read all about that. But the point is that because of the security operations conducted from October 2016 onward, Myanmar has been facing a lot of criticism, clearly, by people who care about human rights and also good governance and all the rest of it. The government maybe hasn't quite lived up to expectations that some would have. The Malaysians were particularly vociferous in criticizing as to what was going on. And she took, again, an unusual step by convening a sort of foreign minister's retreat to explain the government's position on the issue. And to some extent, I think this has worked. But nevertheless, if you look at the kind of comments coming from key people at the UN, the attempts, the United Nations Security Council, to get this discussed, and it was another failure to do so, I think, at the end of last week, or it was kind of a press statement rather released on this. It seems to me that this is probably the one issue where she clearly hasn't done any better than any of the preceding governments. Yeah. So I think we will leave it there. And are there any questions we want to ask among each other?
I have a comment for my dear friend Mama. I just wanted to say something with regard. You and I have had this discussion before about ethnic inclusion with this government. And I have a slightly different stand than you do with regard to the NLD. One, in the ethnic states, there's no question. The ethnic people voted for the NLD because of the basically the slogan of that the NLD would bring change. But they defeat, with that came the defeat of the ethnic parties. And if you speak to the ethnic MPs, NLD MPs, they are subject to party line. So she might have brought in ethnic NLD MPs. There might be more ethnic MPs than before in Parliament, but they are subject to NLD party line. Whereas when they were representing ethnic groups through their own ethnic parties, they were not subject to an NLD party line.
That is what we all wish for, right? Like, you know, so something is always better than nothing. That's what we all wishing for, and that's what we all are fighting for. What do you expect?